Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How important to U.S. interests is the United Nations Security Council, and what role will Barack Obama play in shaping its aspirations and agendas? While representatives of its member states communicate often, the UN Security Council has convened only four summits since its founding in 1946. The fifth one will take place Thursday, focusing on the challenges of global nuclear disarmament. And because the UN system of rotating stints as Council President puts him at the helm this month, President Obama becomes the first U.S. chief executive in history to chair a Security Council summit. David L. Bosco is here to talk about what we can expect in light of the organization's history. He is assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University and a former senior editor for Foreign Policy magazine. His new book is called Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
What is the stated purpose of the UN Security Council?
Well, the purpose, according to the United Nations Charter, is to maintain international peace and security. And I think, you know, for the UN's founders, the idea of maintaining international peace and security, and of course we're talking about the, you know, the end of World War II was when the plans for the UN became concrete. They were thinking primarily about resisting aggression, resisting a new Nazi Germany or a new Imperial Japan that wanted to take over other countries. So that's always been a central idea of what it means to maintain international peace and security. But of course, there are a lot of other dimensions to it as well. The UN Charter talks about the Security Council's role in promoting disarmament, helping control the flow of weapons around the world. And as we moved, you know, decade after decade into kind of the modern times, there have been other dimensions that have been added, including promoting human rights, stopping atrocities, preventing humanitarian catastrophes. So all of that, I would say, goes under the heading, though, of maintaining peace and security around the world.
Throughout its history, David, you see the goals of the Security Council as having aligned along two separate tracks. There is the concert function and the governance function. Will you explain those for us?
Yeah, what I try to, you know, and this book is primarily a history of the Council going all the way back to, you know, 1945 and 1946. And I see two principal functions. First of all, there is what I call the concert function, which is the fact that the Security Council gathers in one room the major powers. It has the major players there. And it encourages them and in some ways forces them to talk about and to debate whatever issues are out there in terms of possible threats to international peace and security. So that process of having them talk is, I argue, a really important one. It's not, however, how most people judge the effectiveness of the Council. Most people say, well, what has the Security Council done to address the violence in Darfur? Or back in the middle 1990s, the question would have been, what has the Security Council done to address the fighting in the Balkans? And often, when we ask that kind of question, the answer is, well, it hasn't done much, or it hasn't been effective at that. And I think that leads a lot of people to kind of throw up their hands and say, well, this organization isn't really useful, it's not doing what it should be doing, and, you know, we need to find other ways of managing peace and security around the world. But I think a lot of people skip over, and they tend to not pay attention to this concert function. Basically, the Security Council has helped to ingrain a habit of consultation and compromise between the major powers. So American diplomats are on the phone constantly with their Chinese and Russian counterparts, in large part, or in part because they're on the Security Council together, and the United States needs Moscow's vote, and it needs Beijing's vote. And obviously the British and the French are circulating there as well. So that habit of keeping the great powers in touch with each other is a very important one, and I think it's played a helpful role in a number of different crises throughout the UN's history.
Let's get a little background here on how the Security Council is set up. It has five permanent members, which are the states that you just mentioned,
right,
and then 10 others that are elected for two-year terms by region.
Yes, basically it's done by regional caucus. I mean, formally they're elected by the whole General Assembly, but most regions kind of pick their candidates beforehand, and they tend to get approved by the General Assembly as a whole. These 10 rotating seats, you know, the countries that fill those seats have two-year terms, and they often feel a bit like outsiders on the Security Council. They feel like the permanent five members kind of run the show because they're there all the time. These other countries come on, they can have influence for a short while, but they certainly don't match the permanent five in terms of influence. And so there's a little bit of resentment that you see throughout the Security Council's history between the permanent members and these non-permanent rotating members. Sometimes the non-permanent members will refer to themselves as tourists on the council. You know, they come on for a short period and then they're gone.
They're like guest stars.
Exactly.
How are the votes of the permanent member states weighted as compared with those of term members?
Right. Well, formally speaking, it's one vote per country. And so if you've got 15 countries on the Security Council, in order to get a resolution passed, you need 9 votes. That's what the UN Charter says. But the wild card, of course, is that the permanent members have veto power. And that means that if they don't like a resolution that's been proposed, they don't like the way the direction the Security Council is heading, they can essentially kill any resolution that they want to. The non-permanent members do not have this power. And so that kind of has created this two-track system, where you have, the veto-wielding powers, and then you have the others.
So one veto is enough to derail any single proposal.
Yes, and what you saw over the history of the Security Council is that back in the late 1940s and the 1950s, up through part of the 1960s, the country that used the veto the most was the Soviet Union. And that is not hard to understand because the Soviet Union was in many respects isolated on the Council. You had Britain, the United States, and France, and then you had China. But China at that point was represented by Taiwan, which was a close U.S. ally. And so essentially the Soviet Union, at least among the permanent members, was isolated, and they responded to that isolation by using the veto all the time. In many cases, it was great propaganda for the United States to force the Soviets to veto something, because then you could say they're being obstructionists, they're blocking effective international action. One of the interesting features of the Security Council's history is that over time, the United States has actually become the country that uses the veto the most. And this began in the early 1970s, and particularly on the question of Israel. The United States often found itself fending off resolutions that were critical of Israel or that the United States felt were imbalanced. And some people have even jokingly referred to Israel as the sixth permanent member of the council because the United States has made a habit of, defending its view of that conflict, which is much more favorable to Israel than the view that many other states have.
Well, and there you come again to the other reality, David, which is the fact that although all these countries have come together on the Security Council effectively to sort of work on global security and stability, they each have marching orders from their country of origin.
Yes, they absolutely do. And there is nobody should have the illusion. You know, I think some of the UN's founders, particularly when they were feeling very idealistic, thought, well, these countries won't behave as countries, they'll behave as guardians of peace and security. And that is certainly not the case. These countries behave in their interests. They defend their interests on the Security Council. And that means that in many cases, you either don't reach consensus or whatever consensus you do reach ends up being kind of a lowest common denominator. And I think that leads to a high degree of frustration with the body and this dynamic that I talked about earlier where people kind of throw up their hands, I think is very much a response to it. And you can understand that, particularly when you consider some of the problems that the UN Security Council is grappling with, you know, genocide or potential genocide in Darfur, you know, mass atrocities, mass rape in Congo. And people say, well, why can't these countries just put aside whatever petty differences they have and work together to solve these problems? But, you know, solving those problems requires resources. Sometimes it requires sanctions or the use of military force. And it's not easy for major powers who have conflicting interests to agree on exactly what to do.
On the other hand, and this tends to raise the hackles of people who are concerned about the UN taking on a sort of global governance role, when the Security Council is in full agreement, they have an extraordinary amount of power and latitude to exercise that power.
Yes, that is one of the, you know, for a body that's often thought to be ineffective or sometimes powerless, one of the amazing things is if you actually look at the UN Charter, and if the council is united, or at least, you know, if you've got enough countries to pass a resolution, it has the power to impose sanctions, to impose blockades, to use force. It really can do what it wants. And there's no real check on the power, there's no formal check on the power of the Security Council. You know, some people have said, well, maybe some international court, like the International Court of Justice, could say, no, Security Council, you've gone too far here. But there's been no real precedent for that. And so the Security Council, in a formal sense, has almost unchecked power. The check, of course, on it is a political one, that most of the time the council can't agree, or when it does agree, it agrees to something much less dramatic than what it could do.
So even with legislative, judicial, and executive authority, there's a lot that comes before the Security Council that doesn't actually come to pass.
Yes, that's right. And but, you know, every once in a while, of course, the Security Council does come together, and it does do fairly dramatic things. So, for example, during the first Persian Gulf War, the Security Council came together, condemned Iraq for its invasion of Kuwait, authorized a military expedition to evict Iraq from Kuwait. And, you know, first it had imposed sanctions on Iraq. And this was all done fairly quickly. And I think a lot of the smaller countries at the UN who had often kind of piously complained about, oh, the Security Council's not working, suddenly they looked around and they realized it is working. And now we're a little nervous that it's working because suddenly, we realize all the powers that this body has. And so there's been this kind of tension throughout the UN's history where people are, particularly small countries around the world, are frustrated when the UN Security Council doesn't work, and then they get nervous when it does start to work because they realize that you know, particularly the permanent five have all this power.
Mm-hmm. And resources to carry out those actions that the Security Council does take, they come from sort of every member state of the United Nations.
Yeah, this has been the original idea of the UN Charter was that every country that was a member of the UN would sign an agreement, basically, with the Security Council that would say, we agree to designate, you know, this infantry battalion or this part of our air force, so that the UN and its council would have basically something like a standing military force that it could use whenever a country became aggressive or there was some threat to international peace. That never happened. Those agreements were never negotiated. And so instead what happens is that, you know, if we take, for example, a peacekeeping mission or some kind of intervention force, the Security Council can authorize it, but then the UN has to go around kind of cap in hand and say, okay, who will contribute to this force? And this has become a major problem if you, for example, look at the force that's deployed currently in Darfur. And I had the opportunity to travel with the Security Council to Darfur and to Congo to kind of look firsthand at those missions.
Let's pause for a minute. You can tell us that story in just a moment because it is a fascinating one. David L. Bosco is with us. His new book is called Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Assistant Professor at the School of International Service at American University, David L. Bosco. His new book is called Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. David, as you mentioned before the break, the Security Council and its delegates, in fact, travels on a regular basis to hotspots within the world, and you had a chance to observe this firsthand.
Yeah, I did. They were making a trip to Africa to basically check in on some of these peacekeeping missions that they have authorized, which makes sense. I mean, they are responsible for kind of managing these peacekeeping operations. And so we went to the Darfur region of Sudan. We went to Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. And we spent some time also in Congo, and particularly in eastern Congo, which has been kind of the epicenter of violence in Central Africa. And it, for me, that trip with the Security Council kind of brought home this dual nature that it has, this function that it has of kind of bringing the big powers together, getting them working together on an issue. And, you know, the diplomats spent 2 weeks together flying around Africa. They established a rapport with each other. One of the interesting things was that the American and the Chinese ambassador, who you might not expect would be kind of traveling companions, would often walk together chatting through refugee camps in Sudan and in Congo. So you could see that there was this value of bringing these diplomats together and having them talk about these issues. On the other hand, what the Security Council is actually doing in these places is clearly inadequate. So the peacekeeping force in Darfur doesn't have enough helicopters. It is not equipped to really restrain the violence in that region. One of the more kind of poignant moments was when the Security Council members went into basically a kind of makeshift hut at one of these refugee camps in Darfur, and they were essentially lectured by the refugees, and the refugees said, "Look, if tomorrow the Janjaweed, you know, these militias come and kill us, you are to blame. You are to blame because it's your responsibility to maintain international peace and security." So it was a quite dramatic moment in terms of some of the most affected people in the world, some of the most desperate people in the world, lecturing the guardians of international peace and security. And so that trip really brought home and, you know, kind of juxtaposed what I see as the good and the useful function of the Security Council, but also its real limitations.
Well, there have been a variety of alternatives proposed to sort of change the way the permanent membership is set up, either adding some permanent members. It would seem to make sense at this point in world history that there ought to be a permanent member from the African continent.
Yeah. No, I think this has one of the most salient and fairest critiques of the Security Council is that it's simply outdated in terms of its membership. You have, you know, its permanent membership in particular is kind of a remnant of the Second World War and how the Second World War ended. And so you have these constant debates. And during the UN meetings this week up in New York, I am sure that most speeches by heads of state will involve a call for reforming the Security Council. And as you say, a lot of people think it's crazy that Africa doesn't have a permanent seat on the council, that there's no one member from Africa who's always there. But the reality is, of course, Africa does have permanent representation in the sense that there are a number of rotating seats that are always filled by African states. And that is true of different regions around the world. So there's always some kind of voice for different regions. My own view is that the membership of the Security Council needs to be adjusted because it really no longer reflects the power realities out there. And that's, in many respects, that's what the Council is supposed to do. It's supposed to hitch power to legitimacy. And so when you don't have India there, when you don't have Brazil or Japan, those are problems, and I think the Security Council needs to address that. the dilemma is that once you open the Pandora's box of reforming the Security Council, there are dozens of different ideas about how you do it, how many additional seats you add. And my fear is that if you increase the Security Council to maybe 25 or 30 members, which some proposals recommend, it will then not have this other function that I identify, this concert function, where it's a kind of useful gathering place, debating forum, and forum for compromise between the major powers.
So it'll be less nimble.
It'll be less nimble, but also less comfortable as a place for major power diplomacy. Like, for example, right now on the Iran question, basically the diplomatic negotiating mechanism that's being used to address the Iran situation is what they call the P5 plus one, so the permanent five members of the Security Council plus Germany. So in this sense, the Security Council is serving as a forum for a debate about what should happen with Iran's nuclear program. If you up the council to 30 members, or 25 or 30 members, I'm not sure that that kind of diplomacy will be as easy, because the council becomes so large that it's less convenient as a negotiating forum.
And as it stands, when one specific country's affairs are being discussed, whether or not they have a permanent or even temporary place on the council, they are allowed to attend meetings that are otherwise held in secret.
Yes. That's right. So any member of the council will attend on a regular basis all of the Security Council's behind-the-scenes deliberations. And one of the interesting features of the Security Council's development is that a lot more now is done behind the scenes than was the case previously. So for a lot of the council's history, you had open debates. You'd have very famous clashes between ambassadors. A lot of these debates used to be televised. It was interesting, in the 1950s, a lot of the Security Council debates were live on American television. And you'd have very famous clashes between the U.S. and the Soviets in particular. What's happened since the Cold War ended, particularly, is that the Security Council tends to meet behind closed doors, and it will basically come up with, it'll figure out what it wants to do, and only then will it kind of emerge and have a formal meeting. So everything is kind of pre-cooked behind the scenes, which has frustrated some countries. It's frustrated countries that are not on the council, that want to know what's going on, and don't like the idea of the Security Council operating behind the scenes. My own view, though, is that that is a very useful thing. It's good to take these ambassadors out of the glare of the television lights, to allow them to talk with some of their colleagues, try out ideas without being publicly committed to them. That's a really useful thing, I think.
So let's talk about what's going on this week at the UN in New York. What was the genesis of this particular Security Council summit, and how do those summits differ in terms of scope and importance from the sort of quotidian operations of the UN Security Council?
Right. So, yeah, this week, in addition to his speech before the General Assembly and the speech on climate change that he gave today, President Obama will chair a meeting of the Security Council, and it will be at the head of state level. So instead of ambassadors representing their countries, you have the heads of state representing their countries. They've done these periodically. One of the most important was early 1992, when you had President George H.W. Bush in the Security Council seat for the United States. And essentially, it's a way of reaffirming the institution's importance, of trying to address at a very high level some kind of issue or a few issues of major importance. The Obama administration, which just by the kind of luck of the draw is chairing the Security Council this month, has decided to focus on nuclear proliferation as their issue. And they've already drafted a resolution, which I think almost certainly will pass, that kind of calls on countries to negotiate seriously about nuclear proliferation. It reaffirms previous Security Council resolutions calling on states like Iran and North Korea to abandon their weapons programs. And so the Obama administration is using the Security Council meeting as a chance to reinvigorate and try to give a fresh momentum to nuclear the effort to control nuclear proliferation.
Of course, there are some critics who see extreme irony in the fact that the five permanent members of the Security Council are declared nuclear states with no apparent intentions of ridding themselves of their stockpiles of nuclear warheads.
Yeah. No, this is one of the things that drives smaller states to distraction, is that there is this double standard kind of built into the UN system, not only the double standard in terms of the veto power and the power that the permanent five have, but this double standard that says certain countries are allowed to have nuclear weapons and certain countries are not. And if you look, for example, at the Iranian president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's response to pressure from the Security Council, he says, "Hey, let's have a debate about the structure of the international system and how unfair certain aspects of it are, including the Security Council." I think what the Obama administration has tried to do with the resolution that it's proposed here, and also just generally with its rhetoric, is to say to the rest of the world, "We understand your frustration, and we think that we, as a nuclear weapon state, and that the other nuclear weapon states have a real responsibility to negotiate and try ultimately to eliminate our own arsenals." I mean, President Obama gave a major speech on this, of course, in Europe, talking about how our goal should be to get to a nuclear-free world. So I think the Obama administration is trying to be more sensitive than perhaps the Bush administration was to this perception of a double standard, but it's also at the same time trying to hammer Iran and North Korea. It wants to keep pressure on them while signaling to the rest of the world, we understand our own responsibilities to try to negotiate away these weapons.
And there, in fact, are three sort of key points up for discussion here. It's arms control and disarmament, nonproliferation, and illegal trafficking in nuclear materials. Do you think that any one of those three will ultimately be the focus of the meeting?
I think they're going to try to carefully touch on all three. And one thing that we should recognize about a meeting like this is that more or less everything has been scripted in advance. You know, I think particularly allies on the council have kind of shared with each other the statements that they'll make. Although it is true that there's a bit of a wild card, which is that Libya is on the Security Council. And I think my conversations with some U.S. officials, there's a lot of nervousness about what exactly Gaddafi is going to say during the Security Council meeting, because if he wanted to make some kind of dramatic show or dramatic gesture, this would be an ideal for him to do that. So, but for the most part, this is a scripted meeting. I think they'll try to focus on each of these three prongs that you identified and say, you know, each of these is important. That, you know, general disarmament, general control of nuclear weapons, but also, you know, nonproliferation and focusing on the illegal trafficking of nuclear material.
There's been all this scuttlebutt concerning whether or not President Obama will shake hands with Mr. Gaddafi. Do you think, I mean, if you were behind closed doors watching these meetings, what kinds of arguments for and against that action are probably taking place right now?
Well, I think my guess would be Obama's instinct is to shake hands. I think he's, you know, and he said this throughout the campaign, that he doesn't believe that kind of isolating and refusing to talk to even countries we have strong disagreements with is very productive. But on the other hand, you know, you have, you know, this was a leader who was involved has been involved in terrorist attacks, including terrorist attacks on, you know, U.S. soldiers going back to the 1980s and of course, the Lockerbie bombing. And so to some Americans, they see Gaddafi not as a world leader, but as someone who has blood on his hands. And I think a lot of what Obama's team at the United Nations will be doing this week is trying to avoid awkward encounters, trying to figure out ways where Obama doesn't have to decide, you know, do I shake hands with Gaddafi or with Ahmadinejad or... because there's really no upside. If he doesn't shake hands, he comes across to maybe a lot of parts of the world as a kind of arrogant standoffish American. If he does, he'll be hammered, particularly from the right wing, for, you know, making concessions to dictators and cozying up to dictators. So I think that's where you have a lot of deft staff work is needed in order to try to avoid those encounters.
Despite his recent sort of domestic dust-ups, it's very clear that President Obama is quite popular internationally. What does he need to do at this meeting to maintain, even before the General Assembly, those favorable attitudes, even if American policies don't change as much as a lot of the world would like to see?
Yeah, and I think there's a certain amount of progress that you can make just by rhetoric, just by the tone. And his team at the United Nations, and I fully expect that Obama's speech to the General Assembly as well as to the Security Council will be generally welcomed and applauded. But there's a lot that you can do just with atmospherics. And his UN ambassador, Susan Rice, has worked hard to change some of that by, for example, joining the UN Human Rights Council, which was something the Bush administration shunned. Talking positively about the International Criminal Court, an international institution that, again, the Bush administration was relatively hostile to. So that goes a long way, I think. But ultimately, it's going to be the issues that are going to matter. And on those issues that are of key importance to the administration, North Korea, Iran, and as well as climate change, which is a major focus of this year's meetings, it's not clear to me that as much has changed as people might think. On Iran and North Korea, for example, you know, Obama still finds himself in the position of having to persuade Moscow and Beijing that tougher sanctions make sense, that we really need to, you know, ramp up the pressure.
David L. Bosco is my guest. He is former senior editor of Foreign Policy magazine, currently assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University. His new book is called Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. Join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Support for KERA comes from you, our members, and from Central Market, featuring a variety of food and beverages for the tailgating season, freshly made patties and sausages, chef-prepared sides, as well as dips, chips, and salsas. Recipes and more at centralmarket.com. Park Place Dealerships, experts in excellence. Located throughout Dallas-Fort Worth with Mercedes-Benz, Lexus, Porsche, and Volvo dealerships, you can choose from their inventory of more than 600 luxury pre-owned vehicles online at parkplacetexas.com.
The Dallas Museum of Art presents All the World's a Stage, featuring over 125 captivating works that illustrate how the human impulse to perform is both timeless and universal. From the grace of Degas' ballerinas to the melancholy of Picasso's guitarist, All the World's a Stage celebrates performance in the visual arts and salutes the opening of the Dallas Center for the Performing Arts. All the World's a Stage. Details at dallasmuseumofart.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David L. Bosco. We're talking about his latest book, Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Dee who writes, "Do you feel the UN is a step in the direction of a world governing body? And if so, could it one day infringe upon individuals' rights as citizens of independent sovereign states?"
That is a fantastic question, and I think very much an open question. I think some people think about the United Nations and they say, this is a kind of rudimentary attempt at a world government, and hopefully we will move closer to a more effective world government. That is not really my view. I think that the United Nations is not and will not become a world government, that there doesn't exist anything like the kind of consensus or even sense of kind of solidarity that you would need for this organization to become a world government. I see it as really a kind of, you know, it's like a stopgap, a kind of patchwork attempt to make sure that the world doesn't go to pieces, that we don't blow each other up, while we all in our own countries go about the work of trying to get good governments, trying to, you know, promote democracy. And so I see the real work is being done at the level of individual governments. But you do need some kind of mechanism internationally to help resolve disputes. And so I see the Security Council very much in that vein. But I think, you know, the emailer is correct in the sense that there are people and there are groups, you know, the World Federalists and others throughout the UN's history who have hoped that the UN would really become a world government. And they've been, I think, bitterly disappointed by the trajectory of the organization.
So, David, to the extent that the UN has been considerably more successful in that, the Security Council, rather, in that concert function as opposed to governance, has it been sort of a failure of its own success in that we don't even really notice its successes in keeping the Big Five from coming to armed conflict?
Yeah, I think that is a major point that I try to make in the book, is that these successes often go unnoticed, and my fear is that the dialogue and the debate about the United Nations so often breaks down into kind of camps where one side has unrealistic expectations for what the organization can do and insists that everything has to be done through the United Nations, that it would, you know, it's unacceptable, for example, to ever use force unless the United Nations approves. And then on the other hand, you have the people who say the organization is useless or even worse than useless, that it's positively damaging. And I'm frustrated that that's where the debate usually ends up, because I see the United Nations as having played, and the Security Council in particular, as having played this very constructive role. But I do not believe that it alone is going to be the answer to world security, or that we can rely on it fully, and we certainly can't kind of put our national security in the hands of the organization. So I do worry, though, that the value of the institution in its kind of concert function does get overlooked.
What accounts for the vastly different perspective that you have throughout much of Europe in terms of the effectiveness and importance of the Security Council as compared with that in the United States?
Yeah, and there is a real sharp difference. And this came out particularly during the run-up to the 2003 Iraq War, where you saw a lot of Europeans saying that you've got to have Security Council approval. You know, without it, any kind of action is illegitimate. And in the United States, the polls were very different on that question. And I think what's going on there is that Europe has been, of course, engaged in this very interesting experiment in trying to have something like a, you know, a regional confederation in the European Union. They're more comfortable with the idea of international institutions and with shedding some sovereignty. They've each of the members of the European Union has gone through a process of shedding important aspects of their sovereignty. And that is something that the United States has not really gone through. Or if it has, it's been in much more limited ways. And so it makes sense to many Europeans that, yeah, if you want to use force, you've got to go through the proper procedures. You've got to go through the Security Council. And to the United States, people say, well, that's crazy. I mean, we have important questions of out here, substantive questions about, you know, Iraq or other issues. And, you know, why, if we can't get the Security Council approval, does that mean we kind of ignore these questions? So there's a real difference in mentality, I think, between Europe and the United States on the role of international institutions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. David L. Bosco is my guest. His new book is called Five to Rule Them All. Let's go on the phone now to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. As far as I can tell, Obama's been charitable, and that's the best way of putting it, charitable about his critics, his vilification, especially on Letterman yesterday. I was wondering how your guest, whether your guest feels that his vilification domestically affects his reputation abroad in general, whether there's any effect there. I'm really curious to see how his popularity abroad plays as this goes on, and you know there's a Jackie Robinson component to this presidency. Thank you.
I think that's a very interesting question, and so far I would say that we have not seen on the international stage the kind of slippage in his favorability rankings and his poll ratings that you've seen domestically. And so in that sense, the Obama mystique, if you will, that existed very much in the United States, you know, around the time of inauguration and has kind of waned since then, is still present internationally. I would expect, and in an interesting way, I think some of the what the caller calls vilification and some of the opposition to Obama domestically actually tends to strengthen him abroad, because the way that many of these debates play in Europe and in other places is that Obama is kind of standing up to, you know, some kind of right-wing or harsh critics. And so in that sense, he may be kind of vilified by certain people at home, but that I don't see that that necessarily diminishes his stature abroad. What will diminish his stature is if people feel like he's not accomplishing things. And one warning sign on that, I think we already see at the UN meetings, is on the question of climate change. Europe and European negotiators in the last few days have become very frustrated with the American stance on climate change, and in particular the fact that the cap-and-trade bill hasn't gone through the Senate. And what the Europeans are saying is, look, we have a global emergency here, and you know, you're not able to push this bill through the Senate because of, you know, health care, but we need to make progress quickly internationally. And so there's some real frustration that's emerging on the part of Europe about climate change. And I think also on the question of Afghanistan, a lot of U.S. allies are starting to feel frustrated that we seem to be, you know, to their eyes, bogged down in a kind of endless conflict, which I think they had hoped. That kind of thing they associated with the Bush administration. That wasn't supposed to be what the Obama administration was about. And yet, here we are in Afghanistan in a situation that a lot of people have compared to maybe 2006 in Iraq, where we're talking about a surge. And so I think as that kind of thing continues, you will see some slippage in Obama's international popularity. I don't think it'll be dramatic, and I don't think Obama would ever reach the kind of levels of international unpopularity that President Bush did.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Jim in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Hey, I'm just kind of confused because at the start of the Iraq War, you know, the big battle seemed to be raging between the UN and President Bush and his administration in terms of whether to go ahead and act on their so-called information as to weapons of mass destruction. As we all know now, the UN was actually right in terms of not only their information, but in their, say, hey, let's just hold on then and wait a second here before we make any rash decisions, which, of course, we ignored completely. My hope was that after that happened, that the UN would find a newfound sense of legitimacy. Unfortunately, and it may just be because of where I live and some resentment that still exists here in this part of the country, I find it not to have happened at all. And in fact, maybe even worse. Got any ideas or comments about that?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. That, you know, as you rightly point out, that in some respects the UN and, you know, the inspectors and the people within the UN system, as well as other countries on the Security Council, who are saying, you know, we don't need to take, you know, any kind of rash action here. Things are, you know, more or less under control. They were shown to be right. But as the caller says, you didn't see a kind of jump in the UN's approval. And I think part of what happened there is that the realization that the UN had been right kind of stretched out over, you know, a number of months. And it was also relatively quickly subsumed by some other scandals. The real kind of scandals about the oil for food program, for example, came out in the wake of the Iraq War, where there was all this information about possible bribery that had gone on between, you know, for example, Russia and a few French politicians and Saddam Hussein. And so I think some of the goodwill, in a sense, that maybe the UN would have enjoyed was subsumed in that, and that people who are hostile to the UN said, yes, you see, it's a corrupt organization, and it was complicit with all of the crimes of the Saddam era. I don't think it was an accident that a lot of that stuff came out at that time, because it was a way for some people in the administration to kind of push back against the UN. And in a sense, I think some people took some pleasure in seeing the UN and particularly the Secretary General suffer a little bit. So I think that's part of why you didn't see this jump in the UN's popularity after the Iraq imbroglio.
You argue here that the assumption that the Security Council is essentially unimportant is just as dangerous as the assumption that it is all important. Can you talk about how those two perceptions tend to play themselves out in the way the Security Council approaches its tasks?
Yeah, well, I definitely do think that they're in many respects equally dangerous. And as we've discussed, you know, in Europe, for example, I think many European politicians go too far in terms of saying that everything has to be done through the UN. I think there are some really important things that we may have to do, and maybe even the Obama administration will have to do without the UN. I can imagine humanitarian crises where we might want to intervene and can't get the approval of the Security Council. I can imagine something happening on the proliferation front where the Security Council's approval isn't possible. So, you know, I do think it's dangerous to imagine that somehow the world's security will be answered by this institution and by simply kind of working through this institution. But, you know, for the reasons that I've argued, in terms of the role the Council has played in helping the major powers navigate through international crises, it's also quite dangerous to think that the body has no role. And that was what really worried me about a lot of the rhetoric you saw from the Bush administration in the run-up to the Iraq War. You, both Bush and Tony Blair, actually, engaged in a lot of rhetoric where they said, if the United Nations cannot respond effectively to the challenge from Iraq, then the organization will be useless. The organization will have failed. It will go the way of the League of Nations. I mean, I'm almost quoting directly from some of the speeches that were given. And I can understand why a politician might be tempted to talk that way, because they're trying to generate support, and you kind of portray things in apocalyptic terms, that if we don't meet this challenge, you know, the whole organization will be defunct. But the Security Council is going to it will always come back. And even though there may be episodes and crises where it can't play an effective role or where its members are divided, you will find that, you know, the next crisis, it may play an important role. And we don't know what kind of crises are going to be coming down the road. I think we're at a very interesting moment in terms of great power relations. We have China, which is, you know, growing more assertive in many respects. We have Russia, which is trying to, I think, kind of recapture some of its past glory, trying to reassert itself on security issues. And so it's a very interesting time in terms of great power relations, and the Security Council is a uniquely important body for managing those great power relations. And so, you know, I think we kind of disregard or mock the institution a little bit at our own peril.
David L. Bosco is assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University. His new book is called Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. David, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.